Who the bloody hell's that?
Morning, Ange.
Ah, Anthony. How are we?
I'm really well. How are you?
Come on in.
I will do, thank you.
Did that sound staged?
Just a little.
No, it'll be fine, yeah.
I'm going to embrace the whole lounge pant thing next time. I'm going to put my University of New Hampshire lounge pants on.
You should indeed.
You're listening to the Corona Diaries, a sometimes random and often irreverent attempt to understand the psyche of singer Steve Hogarth.
Hello and welcome to chapter 13 of the Corona Diaries, which I've been trying to think about a way of describing what this is and I've failed miserably. So I'll just say to you that Steve Hogarth is on screen. He's looking resplendent this morning. And he's had his roots done.
I have. I did them myself. Actually, I'd got an appointment to have them done yesterday and then realised I'd done them myself last week. So cancelled it at the last minute and said, can I move it to next week? And in COVID world, they said, the first appointment we've got is mid-August. I went, are you having a laugh? And they said, no, that's it. I think they're only allowed two people a day or something absurd. So I phoned all the other salons up and... Well, I'm bored with this already myself, so I won't even bother. Isn't it windy?
It is windy. Though I have to say, it's a lot nicer here than it has been for the week. It's been horrible all week, and actually the sun's shining this morning. First time in a week.
Yeah, I was on a bit of a downer the last 2 days, and I think the weather probably played a bit of a part in it. The kind of torrential, dreary rain, and then turning on the news and more COVID, you know. Only interspersed with the economy screwed. You know, it's like waiting for a bomb to drop on you. I was just reading the diary earlier, and I said that the crowd in Utrecht had handled me like a bomb or a lamb. Maybe I'm both, and I thought that was quite an interesting observation because I probably
For the record, I'll confirm you were a little glum yesterday because we had a little natter and you were a little...
Yeah, thrilled. I was on one. Yeah. Well, you can't be cheerful all the time.
No.
Even when you're talking rhyme.
Didn't see that one coming. Well, tell you what then, for the record, to help you, because this clearly is going to help, your Wikipedia page has changed. You've aged... Well, you haven't actually aged.
Right.
Well, you have aged, but you haven't, if you know what I mean.
Oh, they've begun to tell the truth.
Yes.
Right, I'll get on it and fix that immediately.
And get it back to something that's a little bit more...
I'm going to knock 10 years off, I think, next
time. Yeah, I don't know why I stumbled on your Wikipedia page, but it was there that you were back, you were suddenly 64.
Maybe I should deny all of it. You know how I came out publicly in Leicester and said how old I really was? Maybe I should come out again next time I'm in public and say that was a terrible lie and I'm actually only 40.
Right.
And I could just have a fictional age that keeps changing annually. I don't know if that'll cheer me up.
Is that Dorian Gray-esque? Is there some kind of link?
We're getting younger.
We have an abacus in the loft that's going forward and yet your age is staying the same. That might work.
There's a song in there somewhere, but someone's already written it.
We'll leave it.
Probably a shit song.
I don't know if you probably don't know. So if you're not a patron, if you don't go down the route of supporting the show and being involved in the patron thing, you won't know. But there's quite an active kind of sort of group thing that goes on in there with people passing comments on the podcast and bits of conversations going on and what have you. And we found out quite a lot of information actually from the comments that people leave. And obviously the great thing about them is, you know, we do check them and we read them and you're reading them all the time, aren't you?
Well, they're a very valuable resource. I found out how old I actually am and everything.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, and also there's a bit, well, I think you, perhaps, should you, are you going to share it or shall I share it?
Well,
you should.
Do you know what? I'll share it only because I know the guy's name. So a chap called Justin Beeney happened to point out, because we've been referring to Core Blimey Trousers
for many years, actually.
For many years.
Yes.
And And he happened to point out that technically that's not true. They're actually not core blimey trousers.
No.
It's gored blind me. And he wanted to set the record straight. But your inference came from Lonnie Donegan, didn't it?
Or your Justin pointed that out as well. He said, have you been channeling Lonnie Donegan? And he's absolutely right, because what I thought was core blimey trousers is mentioned in the lyric of My Old Man's a Dustman, which I used to sing as a child. And so when I first started wearing these kind of jammy bottoms, lounge pants or whatever you'd call them, after the Brave Tour, because our tour manager, Nick Belshaw, who was also David Bowie's tour manager, used to wear them. And he said, what's with the trousers, Nick? And he said, oh, once you've started on these, you never go back. And eventually I did, and it's true, and I didn't. So he started it all off. And they became known, my trousers became known affectionately as core blimey trousers, which was the first name I could think of for them. Because they do have a kind of, oh my Jesus Christ, sort of element to them. And so I called them core blimey trousers. Nick didn't call them that. I don't think he had a word for his. And they've always been core blimey trousers, and it was Lonnie Donegan who I was referring to. Whether Lonnie sang core blimey or gore blimey, I actually don't know, because I haven't been and listened to My Old Man's a Dustman for a while. But there's something for all you crazy inmates out there listening to the podcast. I dare say you could message me with the truth on Lonnie. But I apparently, as you pointed out earlier, Ant, when we were off air, Gore Blimey was God blind me, and was softened in order not to contravene the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of thy Lord in vain. A bit like Oh My Gosh instead of Oh My God. So a similar sort of thing. So effing and seeing and blinding is absolutely fine with the Lord, but don't mention his name or the name of his son. I've been trying to stop Vibes saying Jesus Christ every time because it... which is hard to do, but it doesn't sit well with me out of the mouth of a 12-year-old, even though I'm not terribly faithful.
Right. Well, the other thing about it, because I did a bit of research on this last night, is the fact that actually the trousers themselves, gored blind me trousers, were trousers that were only fit for sort of not menial, but they weren't suitable to go out in public. So hence the reason why it stems from Dustman, because they had a single use for that. So the kind of core blimey in the sense of, wow, whoa, that's a pair of trousers, isn't actually how it was meant originally. It was more that you looked estate because you were out in public in something that, weren't suitable.
Ill-fitting.
Was ill-fitting and not suitable. So actually maybe we are on the right track. Anyway.
Well, I thought I'd invented that, and apparently I haven't. Isn't it strange how these things happen? You think of something, and then you find out that it's been around for years. Curious.
Oh, well. You sent me a little message through the week to say that when we talked about ICG, we'd not talked about the last thing.
No, I'd completely forgotten about that. And the reason I had was because it wasn't on the original album. We added it to the American version of the album. And that's another story. Which should I tell that story?
You can do. I mean, I'd not heard it, and you very kindly pinged it over, and I listened to it. And it's a fantastic track.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic.
It was something because you know how I'd said, I didn't let the band jam apart from that one moment at the end of the Deep Water. And then I woke up in the middle of the night and thought, hang on a minute, what about the last thing? Because that was more or less jammed in the room towards the end of the process of recording the album. It was a little drum. Again, it was my QY jelly drum machine.
Yeah.
That I'd put the that little rock rhythm in, just in a loop, and I set that running. And I think that's what we used in the mix. It's not a real kit, it's just a machine. And the boys jammed that, and I threw that lyric on top that I'd got kicking about. And Craig Leon didn't really like it. He didn't think it was up to scratch for whatever reason. So he didn't want to put it on the album. And again, talking about Nick Belshaw, I happened to play that song to him a while later, and he said, "Well, you should release that as a single."
Yeah.
So not only did I not release it as a single, it wasn't even on the record. But that was just sort of jammed in the studio, and was, you know, kudos really to Dave Greggs and Richard Barbieri for creating all, you know, weaving those dark distorted colours together, because it's a good thing. It's a good tune. It's very dark. You know, I was trying to get that sort of sense of opening a tomb in ancient Egypt. I've got this notion of the locked box within the locked box within the locked box, and that being essentially the truth that we all carry, that we never speak for fear of causing mayhem and upsetting people. You know, and we all feel that we want the truth out of our fellow human beings, especially our partners and our lovers. But the truth is, when I say it's the last thing, I mean it's the last thing we really want, and it's also the last thing we're ever going to get. So it's the last thing in two senses. Just to explain the tree, I was barking up a little bit. So I had this sort of notion of the truth, whilst on the one hand, you know, being something pure and something we think of as noble, but on the other hand, being like a curse in an Egyptian tomb.
Wow. I'm pleased we've lightened it up a bit. But it didn't appear on the album.
No, Craig didn't fancy it, and you know, he produced the album. It was so. I nearly said it was his album. I guess it was my album. But you know, a producer's job really is to steer the ship, and he didn't fancy going in that particular harbour, and you know. I was on board the boat thinking it might be quite a nice harbour to go into, but he didn't fancy it, and so it never went on the album. And it, I mean, oh my God, Ice Cream Genius. I don't know if I told this story either. I'd done this deal with Castle Communications to release Ice Cream Genius with an A&R man called Doogie Dudgeon, who'd been very supportive during the project, and you know, he'd financed it, or you know, without moaning, and he'd been very positive. And then the day the album actually came out, the release day of Ice Cream Genius, I coincidentally just happened to go and see Steely Dan in Wembley Arena, and right. I was sitting in Wembley Arena. And there was somebody who just happened to be behind me who didn't know me, who was talking to their mate going, "Oh, have you heard about Castle Communications going under?" And he go, "What? Yeah, oh, yeah, everybody's gone, you know, it's done, they've gone bust." And so I turned around and said, "Excuse me, did you just say something about Castle Communications?" He said, "Yeah, they went bust today, everyone was fired." And nobody had phoned me. Can you imagine? No one had even called me and said, "Steve, we're so sorry, but basically you're screwed because, you know, we've released your album and the label no longer exists. Nobody had even bothered letting me know. So that kind of took the shine off my evening a bit. Because I had quite high hopes for Ice Cream Genius. Obviously, I'd put a lot of time and effort and soul into it. And I think if you meet any artist on the planet, you know, any artist who's made records on the planet, they've probably got a story like this one, yeah. You know, of literally having their heart torn in half by the music business. Because you do, as an artist, put so much of yourself into what, at the end of the day, as far as the business is concerned, is just a product and is subject to the vagaries of business and of profit and loss. And so if the label goes broke, well, that's that. No one's ever going to hear of that record. No one's going to promote it. And that's what happened to me. So pretty heartbreaking. Then a little bit of time passed and I realised that when I'd signed the deal with Castle, I'd signed it for the UK and Europe and not America. It was a kind of not America but the rest of the world deal. So I thought, right then, fuck it. I'm going to make up an American label that is a work of utter fiction. So I made up a label called Poison Apple USA and I made a logo for it. And we put Ice Cream Genius out on Racket on Poison Apple America Records because if it was American, nobody could take me to court. And we added an extra track. We added The Last Thing because I thought it'd be nice to put that on there. And we changed the artwork from a sort of dark artwork to like a white cover with a picture of me on it in the pigtails and everything. And we released it ourselves, you know, through the website. And you can still buy it in that form from us. And I was waiting to get a phone call one day, you know, from somebody's lawyer for doing it because it is definitely, you know, the legality of just inventing a fictional American record label that doesn't exist is probably questionable. Castle then got sold to Sanctuary Music. And I was waiting for Sanctuary to ring me up and go, what's going on here then? And then I was in Nottingham one day on tour and I went in HMV. And sure enough, there was my white Poison Apple America version of Ice Cream Genius in the racks. And I thought, how the hell's that got into retail? And I picked it up and I turned it round and it said Sanctuary Music on the back. And what they decided to do is rather than suing me and giving me a lot of grief, they would just nick the entire package, lock, stock, barrel, with the extra track on it and put it in resale and go, well, two can play at that game. There was not really a lot I could do about it. I should have bought it because I don't have a copy of it and it's probably quite a collector's item. So I thought that was quite amusing.
So they've had to copy then. They've had to, because you printed it first time round, didn't you?
Yeah, somebody's bought it from Racket, copied the CD, copied all the artwork, and then, you know, and then changed the Poison Apple America logo to Sanctuary and stuck it in retail. Oh, dodgy buggers. They're as dodgy as I am.
So hang on then. Did you get royalties from that? Because when they bought Castle, they...
That probably returns us to our last week's conversation where nobody knows where royalties come from or why they get them and or why they don't, for that matter.
Yeah.
But I know that, I mean, I would have owed Castle Communications a small fortune when that, you know, because what the way the music business works as well is that they advance you whatever, you know, they advance you money That's what an album deal is or a record deal is. They give in inverted commas you some money to live off and to make a record, and that is all recoupable, which means that if that record sells and you're on, say, for instance, 10% of the selling price of that record, they take 90% of every record sold, and then they take your 10% and they knock it off what you owe them for making the record. So basically, if your records cost 10,000 quid, by the time they consider that you've broken even because you've recouped your 10,000 quid, they've put 90,000 quid in the bank.
Yeah.
But you've, you know, but whilst all the time making you feel like you owe them money. And that's the genius of the music business and the way record deals work. So you can have a million selling album, which recoups the artist, you know, £100,000, whilst the label has put 900,000 quid in the bank. And obviously, you know, it costs a label, record labels, it costs them money to function, to pay their own rent and to have their shiny buildings. And their sports cars and whatnot, but I mean that, you know, that's where all the money goes, really, and you can be selling an absolute ton of records and still feel like you owe them money. That's the genius of the entire business, and they use that feeling to control artists. Well, you know, you still have got a debit balance of £300,000, you know, and you could think, Jesus, is it that much? Right, what do you want me to do then?
Yeah.
They don't say, well, actually, we've stuck a couple of million away from that last album and we'd like to make another one, you know, and you go, oh, isn't it great? I owe them £300,000 and they still want me to make another album for them. Oh, the love. I'm feeling the love, you know, and the commitment and the faith. And then, you know, the years pass, you get older and you finally see how the whole thing works. You become a terrible cynic. And that's where I've arrived at.
Funny, it wasn't coming through.
but I can laugh.
Well, No, and let's face it, it makes excellent content.
So every time I hear Steely Dan now, there's a little part of me that goes,
do you know what? I feel exactly the same way.
For different reasons.
For a totally different reason. I never really, Steely Dan never worked for me. And I know a lot of purists look at me like a proper heathen, but I just don't get it. Anyway,
yeah.
So the last thing goes on the American version. But at what point did it come about in the process? Because it sounds like a band that had been working together for a while. So was it towards the end of the process?
Yeah, it was right on the very tail end of everything. We just happened to be in the room together, and we just bashed that out for fun, really. And I think that maybe part of the reason Craig didn't want to put it on the album was he'd mixed the record and he'd closed it down in his mind. You know, yeah. he was done with it, and here we were at the death, suddenly going, what about this? And I just don't think he could get his head around it.
And yeah, I was listening to a thing the other day, an interview with Def Leppard, where they had exactly the same situation. So they'd been working on Hysteria for like years, and it had cost a gazillion.
Haven't
quid.
We all?
and they, Joe Elliott was riffing on the song that became Pour Some Sugar, and they ended up, Mutt Lange, who was producing it, ended up saying, no, that's going on the album. Complete reversal situation. And he said, no, that's going on the album. Said to the record company, we need another 3 weeks. And they did it, wrote it, recorded it in 3 weeks. And it ended up being the biggest selling single off the album.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how, you know, with what you said about not only could it have been on there, but it could have been a single. And you look at the two different ways that story goes, and it's, you know, maybe you should embrace those things when they happen. If a piece of magic happens.
Yeah, whatever a piece of magic is, you know, I mean, yeah. The thing about as I've said before about music and the music business, is that no one really knows anything. People only know what they like and what excites them and what doesn't. And you can line five guys up in a room, you know, one will tell you that Steely Dan's the best band that ever exists, and Ant Short will go, never got it, didn't like it. And the same obviously happens in the music business. You can line up five A&R men in a room and, you know, what about this? And one of them will say, that's a stone cold hit. And the other one will go, nah, don't see it. And so in that sense, your entire career path has got as much to do with luck and, you know, which balls fall into which holes when and which ones just don't, as anything else. And for every mega successful genius out there, there's another kid who will never be hailed as a genius and no one will have ever heard of, and it doesn't mean he's not really talented.
No,
it's down to luck. It's down to luck, and I think that's why self-belief and belligerence is so important. If you're gonna get anywhere as an artist, you've really got to believe in yourself. But the fact is that a great many pure artists are absolutely plagued with self-doubt and will always listen to the people who don't get it. They won't listen to the people who go, oh, that's great. You go, oh, do you think so? And then someone else go, I don't really get it. And you'll think, yeah, he's right. It's shit, isn't it? You know, so I think if you're... The purer you are as an artist, I guess the more self-critical you become and the harder it is to just bulldoze your way through other people's doubt and negativity. But then there are certain people in this world who maybe aren't the most talented artists that just have that drive. Shall I just go, Madonna? You know, they have an unstoppable, they're an unstoppable force. It almost doesn't matter what kind of music they make. There's no stopping them, and they'll do anything for success. And those people tend to do very well.
Well, I did want to get on to the topic of, but I don't know if we've got time for this. Might have to carry this into next week's episode. I did then want to get onto the topic of album sequencing, because part of it made me think, well, was it that that the album was done or was it an issue of? Because it does sound a little bit different to all the things on the album. And it then made me think, well, actually, what happens when you get a song that doesn't fit with the rest? And you know, where had you, like, did you tack it on the end of the American thing because it was easier to put it on the end, or is that where you, because it was called The Last Thing, do you think, well, that's the best place to put it?
I mean, you can't put The Last Thing first, can you? I mean, you can't put the last thing anywhere except last. Well, I guess you can. You can, yeah, if you're being arty and avant-garde and controversial, of course you can. Yeah. And that's exactly where you put it. But no, I just thought it sort of, probably because of the process as well and the fact that Craig didn't want it on the record, it felt like an afterthought as well. So that the place to put it was on the very end.
Yeah.
I don't think it even crossed my mind to try it anywhere else. Mm. But album sequencing, in general terms, is important, I think, and does make a difference to how an overall collection of songs are perceived somehow. And what we tend to do, what we've been known to do, I don't know if we still do it, I think we still do it within Marillion. Once we've got all the mixes done, we actually sample... I guess you could do it. You can do it all in Logic now. But before we were all using sequencers, we would sample the first 10 seconds of a song and the last 10 seconds of a song, and we'd put it on. We'd stick it on a keyboard, you know. So middle C would be song one intro. The D would be song one end off. You know, E would be another song. you know, beginning and end. So we had the beginnings and ends on keys, so you could just press a key and you could faff about and go, oh, the end of that into the beginning of this is quite nice. And you were just looking, I think you were looking for, what seemed to work. It's not even as simple as saying, well, relative key or relative tempo, or just a feeling, really. And it would, you know, you'd faff about and then you'd go to the band and go, what about this? You know, and they go, oh, that's quite nice. So I've got one. What about this one? And you sort of take a vote on it. And I know for sure that's how we sequenced Afraid of Sunlight once we'd got all the songs written and recorded. Probably while Dave was still mixing, we took rough mixes. I think I went upstairs in Parr Street with Mark Kelly, and we sampled them and we faffed about on a keyboard and said, "What, you know, this is quite nice in here. This is nice in here," and we sequenced it like that.
Cool. Right, well, we'll leave it there because I think it's about time we had a better diary. Though that's a topic we might come back to, because I am absolutely fascinated by that particular topic, and I'd certainly be interested to hear how you came up with the same thing for Ice Cream Genius. But we'll leave it for another day because we'll end up banging on for hours. So diary wise, I think we're end of November into December time. You just met Bonnie Tyler, but you mentioned Ringo last week. I think in the questions when we were chatting, you mentioned Ringo, which actually I think is going to be in the first day of this
hadn't
week.
Hadn't been in that bit. It'd been in this bit. Yeah, so I was a bit ahead of myself. Yeah, I think I just got. We went to Munich, didn't we, last week to do a telly? And we just sort of flew there. Did something, said hello to Bonnie Tyler, came home again. And then then I think we were into the next leg of the Holidays in Eden tour.
So yeah, bit of downtime at home and then into the next leg. So we'll do that and then I can probe you about the details in the wrap-up.
Righty-ho, I'll brace myself.
Yeah, deep breath.
Thursday, 28th of November. Up at 9 with something in my eye. Couldn't find it, went back to bed and rose at 10 to check out at 10:30. Had coffee in the Hilton lobby and was minibused to Munich Airport to fly home. Fog at Heathrow left us delayed on the tarmac in Munich until the time of writing, which is 10 past 1. Finally got clearance to leave Munich, arrived at Heathrow to no fog and was given immediate clearance to land. Saw Ringo Starr come through arrivals, trailing a small bag on wheels and looking fed up. I think he may be smaller than me. Friday, 29th of November. Up at 7:30 with Niall and Hargreaves, Diz got up around 9 and took Fee to a workshop while I looked after Niall, who was unsettled and irritable. When he finally quietened down, I watched the first 20 minutes of Apocalypse Now until the girls returned. In the afternoon, I had an hour in bed, still feeling ropey. Rearranged the back room again. After Hargreaves went to bed, I hired Room with a View from the video shop. Very bright set and fairly dull. I'm finding it hard to relax. Saturday, 30th of November. Up at 7:30 again with Sophie. Around 9:30, a man came to value the house. The news wasn't good. It's now worth the same as we paid for it, despite all the work we've done and the small detail of a new roof. We buggered about for 2 hours trying to get out of the house, as only people with babies can understand, then drove for an hour to Oxfordshire to check out the housing market. We're going to have to move out there to be nearer to Marillion's new studio. Neither of us want to. We like living in Englefield Green. We ended up, after stopping for late pub lunch at the Fox Farthing Home, in Brackley, a small town in Northamptonshire. Saw some interesting properties at almost affordable prices and drove home. Went to the video shop and hired Pretty Woman. Very sweet. I have arranged to view properties round Banbury and Brackley tomorrow, but I think we'll cancel as it's such a long way and we haven't even put our house on the market yet. Sunday, 1st of December. Up at 7:40 with Fee, clutching Postman Pat advent calendar. Took Niall downstairs so Diz could have a lie-in. Chaos until 11 when she appeared. I promptly went back to bed until 1:30. I think my cold is worsening. Got up and had a bath and long debate about moving house. Dizzy doesn't want to move away, but I need somewhere to write. It looks like a conservatory is the solution. I'll get on to it tomorrow. Didn't go out apart from a bit of leaf sweeping around the paths. Went to bed with Lem Sips. Monday, 2nd of December. Got up with Hargreaves at 7:30, had breakfast and phoned a man about conservatories. He's coming to have a look on Wednesday. When everyone was up, we all piled into the car and drove to London for lunch at the Hard Rock Cafe, followed by a visit to Santa on the third floor at Selfridge's. For once, the traffic was below the pain threshold and we found somewhere to park without being clamped. The Hard Rock is decorated for Christmas, and a Christmas tree of unfeasibly large proportions stands outside once again. Drove home. Daryl Way popped round to meet Niall for the first time, and we had an hour in the Beehive. That's the pub just down the road. Tuesday, 3rd of December. Up at 8, took Sophie to school and Diz to Staines where she was potting. That's kind of making pottery. Drove to London with small passenger to pick up Sarah Ball's original painting for the Holidays in Eden album cover. The band had graciously given me first refusal on it, so I have arranged for her to frame it for me. Got stuck in the horrendous traffic in the city. I was supposed to pick up Hargreaves at 12, but I was still at St Paul's at 11:40. The traffic eased once I got to the embankment, and I managed to get back to Egham for just after 12:10. Picked Sophie up and dropped the painting home, went back to Staines and we joined Dizzy for Christmas Potter's Buffet. Chatted to Sue Bradley about her daughter who won't sleep. She's willing to try anything and has been taking her to a cranial osteopath for head massages. In the afternoon, Bessie had Sophie for a couple of hours while we wrestled with Niall and watched Prime Suspect, which we had videoed last night. Hargreaves returned and pulled the breadboard off the kitchen work surface onto her head amid much noise. Wednesday, 4th of December. Dizzy took Fee to school while I looked after Niall. She then went to the supermarket and hurried back for 10 to be there to meet the conservatory man, Lewis. We waited in all morning and he never turned up. He eventually called at 1, apologising profusely. He thought we'd arranged Thursday. Fraying tempers gave way to controlled excitement as he measured up and showed us what was possible. If he's as good as his word, and if we can afford it, it will look lovely. Dizzy went for a lie down around 3:30 and didn't stir all afternoon. I woke her with tea at 5:30. Stayed in for the rest of the evening. Didn't quite manage to go to bed early. Thursday, 5th of December. Home, Utrecht, Vredenburg Music Centrum. And so to Utrecht. The doorbell rang at 9:50. It was my cab. I thought I'd better pack. Packed at speed and kissed my family goodbye for 10 days. That's both hands, Fifi. The flight to Schiphol was painless. We arrived 10 minutes early and were driven to the Hotel Smits opposite the Music Centrum. Dropped my bags and went to say hello to the crew who were wrestling with a mains hum, which was to remain with us for the show. It transpires that today is St Nicholas Day in the Netherlands and is a big celebration here. We had restructured the set completely for the next leg of the tour and unrehearsed we were a bit uncertain of what we were doing. Bolstered by the feeling that we can get away with murder in Utrecht, we went on and made it up as it happened. This resulted in the show having a spontaneity and humour which was inspirational and electric. From my point of view, this was one of the all-time highs in on-stage experiences. If it could be like this every night, I'd do it for free. Wait a minute, I do. After the show, I put myself to bed with hot lemon as my cold is still plaguing me. Early night, 1 a.m. Friday, 6th of December, Utrecht, Frydenberg Music Centrum, 2. Put all my efforts into a long lie-in, didn't get up till 1, went for a walk and a pleasant lunch in the town. Back to the theatre. We'd arranged to rehearse in the afternoon at 3. At 5:30 we left the stage to give the Violets, our opening band, a decent crack at a sound check, and I rehearsed up Merry Christmas, War is Over with Steve R and Pete T in the dressing room. Back at the hotel, I answered a Dutch fan letter inquiring as to the significance of the Rake's progress, which had been meticulously studied by the Enquirer. They want it all explained. Back at the gig, Inga from Delft showed me a book she'd made from Europeans, my first pro band, newsletters and fan mail. I asked her if she would make a copy for me. It turns out that tonight is fan club night. We all thought that was yesterday. What will they be like tonight? I didn't have to wait long. The audience was totally unbelievable. It's hard to take in and appreciate what's coming at you at shows like these. I get frustrated by my own inability to be blown away by the passion of such reactions. But you simply can't. It's incredible. But it's so unnatural to be presented with it that you simply can't do it justice with a response. It's a good job, really, because if my reactions were proportionate, I wouldn't be able to sing. Breathing would be a struggle, let alone anything else. We changed the set again. The band played brilliantly. I had to be retrieved from the audience by production manager Smick during the encores. I have no reason to be scared of these people. They handled me like a lamb or a bomb. I guess I'm both.
And we're back. What a fascinating little sort of snippet of diary life that was. I like the little bits. I mean, I know I should be really into the tour bits and this, that and the other, but I do quite like the little insights into the home life, into that frantic thing that must go on when you come back knowing you've got a week or 10 days and a load of shit to sort out.
Yeah, it was always like that, you know, that, you've got 4 days off, and you'd walk through the door to a pile of post and bills, and what are we going to do about this, and what are we going to do about that, and the kids need this, and the kids need that, and of course the kids haven't seen you for a while. And back in those days, there was no FaceTime or any of that, and phoning home was a big issue because there were no mobiles, so you'd have to phone from hotels, and they knew that, and so they used to rip you off. So you'd get on the phone for 10 minutes and they'd present you with a bill for 35 quid on your way out in the morning. And because of that, all the phone calls used to be, how are you doing? Yeah, I'm fine. I've really got to go. You know, and that was your... That's how you held a relationship together with your wife and your kids. It was just, you know, it was so hard. Probably more for them than for me. It was, you know, I was just riddled with guilt constantly. But they were, you know, my kids miss me and my wife missed me. My wife needed me to address things and make decisions, and that I didn't. And then I'd come home into this whirlwind of stuff, you know. The kids need affection. The kids need things. The boiler's exploded. The dishwasher needs plumbing in. You know, we've got a bill from Anglian Water that makes no sense. What are we going to do with it? You know, can you phone them? So all of the mundane crap that people do all had to be shoehorned in to no time at all. Which made, looking back, we seemed to cope with it amazingly well, considering. Well, I don't think I could cope with it now. But then I've got used to FaceTime and a mobile phone and, you know, unlimited video chats and all of that. It's made like for free, for no money, which has made touring so much easier.
Yeah.
Of course, now we've got COVID and we can't tour. But
so the two then, big things, the two big things in you that struck me in your little in that little bit was, you seem to be keeping the local video shop in operation for that for that week. I'm trying to think, was it Apocalypse Now, Pretty Woman, Brideshead Revisit, or Room with a View? I mean, you know, a fairly eclectic list.
Yeah, I'm going to say, how many people watch Apocalypse Now and Pretty Woman back to back? That's a pair of movies that arguably don't belong together.
Well, I could see how you could do Apocalypse Now and think, I need something a bit lighter.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it was the right way around. If you'd watched Pretty Woman and gone, oh, bloody hell, I need Apocalypse Now after that, then that would have been a bit worrying.
I think I probably would have. I'm one of those people who would watch Pretty Woman and then feel desperate for Apocalypse Now off the back of that. And I probably did. But I tended to watch that on my own, even though I think, you know, I think it's one of the best movies ever made. You know, it's not a rom-com, is it?
No.
Girls tend not to get it. Girls tend not to want to watch, you know, blokes shooting each other, man's inhumanity to man. They want, ooh, will they get together? Ooh, won't they get together? That's what girls want, isn't it? Boys, I don't know. I mean, I personally... There's something about Apocalypse Now. There's an inherent darkness. It's like the last thing, you know. It's that lockbox within the lockbox thing. That dark place, Heart of Darkness. Of course, it was inspired by Heart of Darkness by Conrad, and it is all about going and searching for, you know, the devil. At the end of the day, and staring that in the face and addressing it, and, you know, and the music's great. What Coppola did with all of those, all those wailing synthesizers, and then the way he used the darker tracks by The Doors. I mean, it's just an amazing movie, and we mixed Brave to that movie. We had the sound down. And we had that movie on a loop for the whole of the Brave mix, which, you know, took weeks and weeks. And Apocalypse Now just went round and round and round while Dave Meegan was mixing Brave. But by that point, I think Dave was a bit on the edge anyway.
It's a wonder you all got out alive.
We weren't going to tell him to turn that film off. He might... That might have been the last straw. You better leave him alone. He's watching Apocalypse Now for the 27th time, you know, and he's on mix 4. Leave him alone. You know.
And for the record, I quite like Pretty Woman, but we'll leave that one. So the other big thing, because I have to ask, Conservatory.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't remember any of that looking back. I think we decided I needed a place to work. It was only a little house, 54 Middle Hill. And we must have decided we need a conservatory. And we got a man in to have a look. I barely remember that. And he gave us a lot of interesting options and ideas. And apparently we got excited. And then I dare say, even though I don't know, I would have thought he came back with a quote that just made us faint. And at which point we will have ceased to be excited. And then we probably ummed and ahed a bit and then realised that we'd really got to move house because Marillion had decided to throw all their eggs in the basket that became the Racquet Club. And it was too far to commute to. You know, I drove to the Racquet Club a couple of times from Windsor. And by the time I got there, I didn't want to do anything. I thought, I just, you know, this ain't going to work. And we were happy in Windsor. My wife was particularly happy. And I did eventually persuade her somehow to sell up and move out to the countryside where she didn't know anybody. And, you know, and then I did the decent thing, buggered off on tour and left her on her own. I mean, I could write you a very long list of why we're divorced, and that's probably item 134.
And maybe over the past couple of days you might have thought about starting that list, but, you know, hopefully today that's not you.
God, poor girl. She did her best, and I'll never forget it.
I think on that light-hearted moment, we'll perhaps leave it for this week.
No, I mean, I don't feel down about it. It's all good. It's all good, you know. I mean, if we'd never split up, I never would have met Lynetta. I never would have had Vibes. You know, sometimes life's tragedies are seeds for beautiful things, and they often are. You know, you don't see it at the time. You just feel it, the trauma. But, you know, as one door closes, another one slams in your face, as my mother used to say.
Well, that brings us to the end of episode 30. It's been a little bit strange this morning.
Has it? Has it been strange? Yeah, I think that's your fault. You're in a funny mood, Ed.
Yeah. It's clearly me. Yeah. It's clearly me. Yeah. I'll have to sort myself out for next time. But yeah, so anyway.
Let's not leave the punters on a downer.
Actually, do you know what I was going to say as a little thing, actually? Because this will go out, this will be going out in a week's time or so. And what we can say is that at that point in time, we'll have pushed out some extra content for our Purple patrons. Yes. So as you're hearing this, you'll have some extra things to listen to as well, because we've recorded another Q&A, haven't we? We did another Q&A with questions from the guest book, and that's about ready to go out. So there's that nice little positive thing to go out for the Purple people. They've got that, you know, they've had this and they've got more to come.
Yeah, great. Oh, and if you are Purple and you're enjoying it, and thanks for your messages saying that, you know, some people are saying it's the highlight of their week, which is great, especially in these weird times we live in. But do get on social media and spread the word, because we're still short of really being able to finance this thing properly. So we'd be grateful for any spreading of the word and any new subscribers we can come by. We would hate to have to stop this, because we had such a lot of fun doing it.
We're currently sharing a tea bag, which is a bit of a problem because we're 150 miles apart.
Yes.
But, you know.
Yes, you know, and the post isn't what it used to be.
not what it used to be at all. It's quite damp when I get it.
Well, I just tend to put the envelope in. makes it a bit clarty.
Yeah, a manila tea. That's probably a thing somewhere around the world. You probably could order a manila tea somewhere. Oh dear.
Vellum.
What a
great word there.
Right. Well, we're off, because I've got another call in half an hour. I've got to be serious. I've got to be proper and well behaved.
We can't be talking about a vellum when you've got another call.
No, not when I've got another call coming in. No. Oh dear, good grief. Siri just kicked in.
Oh.
Siri actually just kicked in and said, "I'm always serious, Ant."
Oh.
There we have it.
I think it's spooky the way those machines listen to you all day long.
Well, do you know what? We've been talking about a little, you know, these little office things you can have in the garden. So it's like a shed that you plaster and has electric in it, and you can... And because through this, Alison's been working at home a lot. She's currently working out of a bedroom, and she's going to be working at home more. So we've talked about whether we have one of these little pods in the garden, and I get kicked into the garden.
Yeah,
and we've had a few conversations about it, and that's it. And my Facebook feed is now full of adverts for those things. So something is listening to me, because I've not searched for it anywhere.
That's super spooky, isn't it?
So it's either the phone or it's the Alexa, but something is listening.
Mm, and there's probably a couple of trigger words and you get the SWAT team around at dead of night.
Yes. I better not talk about doing anything serious to Boris.
Mossad.
Oh, that's all right. They're heading round to your place next.
They're all on the green. They're in the trees.
Pair of size 12s about to come through that window.
The house is surrounded by helicopters.
Oh, nicely done. I saw what you did there.
Right.
Okay. Well, listen, you take care.
Look what I'm
and
doing.
We will.
Yes, you we'll, take care, Ant.
And we'll speak to you all next week.
We lightened it up at the end with a bit of terrorism.
Yeah, I think we pulled it round. I don't think anybody noticed.
No. Thank you, Sonia Gerritsen. And David Beckwith. Patrick van der Splinter. And Celia Steinmeier. And Elijah Moore. Thank you, Richard Wigley and Andrew Dirks and Johann Frederick Holst. Thank you, Gray Abrell, Mark Cleaves and Alistair Wallace. And Scott Yonkers, who's also Scott Johnson, and Andrew Muscat and Jim Bunnan, Reese Page, Matt Schofield and Patrick Hanna and Karsten Poot. Thank you, Glenn Stokes and David Ibbett. Someone who calls themselves Quartz, but is really Dave Martin. And thank you, Matthew Hammond and Glenn Rowland. Robert Patrick and Simon Cooper and Chris Staples and Johan Herold and Jenny Kenworthy. Oh, I've got to scroll down. Here we go. All right, Jenny Kenworthy and Stuart Miller. Jenny Luca John Edwards and Zoe Barraclough and Scott Forte Trevor Coyle and my good friend Toodles and Des Sage. Thank you, Ian Bell and Robert Harley and Matthew C. Paul Cross, Keith Pitt, Patrick Jacks, Roy Elliott, Glenn Barrett, and Caroline, and Caroline Smithson, whose name rings a bell. Maybe we went to school together, or maybe it's another one. Not forgetting Ian Nicholson, Edward Glass, Serian Blythman, Damien Grace, Isla Balfour, what's a hell of a name? I might leave it there. Maybe I'll sign off with, and thank you, Vicky Goodman. And Martin Gorman. And John Cavan. And Kevin Spicer. And Gary Foster. And Andrew Wildman. Good to be purple. Well, it's good to be anything. Lots of love.
Thanks for listening to the Corona Diaries. It featured Steve Hogarth with the insights and me, Ant Short, with the questions. If you enjoyed the podcast, please consider subscribing and maybe leaving a review, as this will help others find it. You could even share with other like-minded souls, should the mood take you. This has been an A Short Stories production.